Welcome to another episode of The Gateway. My name is Russ, and as always, I am joined by my co-hosts Amin and Biagio.
For this episode, The Gateway is excited to welcome David John Baker, the director and founder of Red Granite Group. His consultancy provides expert data services to small to medium-sized companies looking to fully leverage their own data to make the best strategic use of the resources they have today. He also develops data products within his area of expertise, the performing arts, higher education, and audio branding.
Dave, welcome to The Gateway. It is a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited to be here and talk with everyone.
So, Dave, all of our listeners heard your incredible bio, and I loved your bio at the end of just being like, hey, here's my expertise. Like, the performing arts, higher ed, data, like everything. So I'm really excited about this conversation because I think we're going to cover a lot of different topics here. But before we get into all of that stuff, I like to begin at the beginning. How did you get to where you are today? What's your story?
Yeah, I took a very meandering path to get here. It's worth talking about for anybody that feels that the background that they have is sort of inappropriate for getting into data science or analytics or things like that, because I really took sort of a strange pathway. And so my background is actually in music. I did an undergraduate conservatory degree, and I just played trumpet for like 4 years. And then I essentially realized I didn't only want to play trumpet. I didn't find it as intellectually fulfilling as maybe I thought it would be later on. So I took some time off, re-pivoted, ended up doing a master's in psychology and music psychology as a kind of way to jump from one thing, sort of deep humanities, into over the sciences. And then I ended up going, basically falling in love with that world, the sort of area of music perception and cognition, because all of the things that I thought were going to be answered in the world of music theory turned out actually just to be scientific questions and not what's typically referred to as like music theory and music analysis questions. So then ended up doing my PhD at Louisiana State, which is where I met Biagio and had a
I've heard of them.
Go Tigers.
Exactly, go Tigers. had a very lovely time there. And then for a very long time, I was sort of in this world of music perception and computation, and didn't really have a lot of formal training in the more technical stuff, but basically the questions that I wanted answered really required this type of technical learning. So I'm very much self-taught and very much of the persuasion that if you just sit in a room long enough with a textbook and your own patience, you can learn a lot of things, which I think I got from my training as a musician. And then I just sort of rode that train for a very, very long time. The more technical skills you get, the more people call you sometimes to do technical things. So I started to do data science stuff on the side, finishing up my PhD, straight out of my PhD. It was sort of the golden age of data science education. I ended up getting a job as a lead instructor of data science at Flatiron School, which is a boot camp that was quite popular at the time. I'm pretty sure it's still around and kicking out students. Then ended up going back to academia, did some bit more data science on the side. And now I've moved back to the United States. I was living in London and Amsterdam for a bit, and have gone now full freelance with my data science skills. So it's kind of all over the place, but it's really like you have a question, you have to have it answered, and you sort of put in the work that you need to learn those skills. And that's how I've arrived at the sort of strange resume that I have today.
Well, I do appreciate that willingness to say, hey, I took a different path. And especially with something like data analytics, a lot of people your age and even older and then younger, data analytics wasn't really, it was there, it was out there, but it's not like what it's been in the last 10 years of just that, oh, hey, there's these programs, there's these things, you need these skills, this is where it is. And I think for those students or individuals in their career thinking about making a shift or saying I'm falling behind, or the perception of falling behind, it could be very intimidating to say, I can't make that switch. I'm stuck in this position and everyone's going to leave me behind. So I really appreciate your kind of thinking on that one. Do you, in your day-to-day, other than the determination, the dedication to just practicing a scale or just that musical determination, do you associate any of those other attributes you developed in that side of your education, your experience, to what you're doing in data analytics now, or are they, it's too far removed?
Yeah, I think you can draw some parallels if you want to. I think the clearest ones are those, is that ability to kind of go deep on things and be okay to spend a lot of time in your own head and struggle. I think that's one of the big things in music. You learn a lot about how it is, you're probably not going to sound better from, you know, if anything, you're going to sound worse by the end of your practice session. And I think with learning like statistics and programming, a lot of the time you'll feel like you understand it less than when you started. But then as the days and the weeks go by, that type of sort of growing compounds and you do learn in a way. So that's, I think, the highest level parallel to that that I could draw. I think you could draw a lot of other parallels if you wanted to, but I think the other maybe big one is that I'm quite drawn to things that like really interest me, and music really interests me. So I'm able to spend lots of time doing it. And with data analytics and data science, it's the answer to the question that really influences me in terms of how I want to spend my time and energy and focus. And I just don't really want to let anything get in my way of my ability to answer what originally prompted it in the first place. And I think science and music are quite similar in that regard. You just have to be completely almost like, I don't even know, I want to say like naive, but like
just oblivious to everything else almost. Yeah, you're just like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Dave, for me, when I think of musicians, and especially anyone who adopts the trumpet, that has such a history behind that specific instrument. Do you feel, when you were trying to develop those skills, did you feel that history in that instrument itself of kind of knowing it, or were you just trying to make your own path? And the reason why I'm bringing that up is, do you kind of feel that similar motivation of math, of answering these large human oriented questions? Is there any kind of correlation with that of that looking back on where we are, or is it literally just, hey, I'm doing this right now, and it's a question. It's I want to master this piece of art. I want to create this thing. Does any of that make sense?
No, I definitely see where you're coming from with this. Yeah, it's strange. I think in some ways you're tempted in both, and I guess in all forms of learning, to kind of like reinvent the wheel and like start at the beginning of history and like figure it all out and sort of see where everything goes. And you really see this in the data science pedagogy. Everywhere you go, it's like, oh, you got to go back to calculus. You got to go back to, you know, linear algebra. You have to go back this, or else how could you ever understand all the stuff that's going on? And then, like, I get that, but I also sort of feel like you could take it to an ad absurdum type arguments, like, well, if you're going to get computers, well, if you're programming in R, you might as well learn C++, because a lot of the stuff runs there. And if you're going to do C++, you might as well drop down a couple, because how can you ever understand how pointers work if you don't understand like language? And like, to me, it doesn't necessarily track. And I understand why people say this, because we're also living in a time where everybody can claim to be a data scientist. You really want to have things that you can do and say that kind of people who maybe are just like faking it or just dropping stuff into ChatGPT might not understand. But I think that comes with time in terms of like really understanding the scope of like, what are you actually doing? Why are you doing it? And how are you going to kind of just continue to go deeper, knowing that it's all going to kind of connect eventually? And I think everybody wants this like optimal path, right? Because everybody's about optimization and spending all of their time, but like really, if you kind of trust that everything is going to connect at some point, then, you know, especially if you're new, like everything is going to be good. You just don't understand why it's going to be good at first. And I think the same thing with music as well. So it's like, I think, and find an entry point that really gets your attention and something that you can like spend a lot of time doing, and then just keep plowing forward on that, knowing that you're going to run into stuff that's maybe boring, maybe not as, I don't know, as captivating at first, but you will have to get through it eventually if you want to kind of keep growing in that space.
I have a question. This might sound like I'm asking personal advice, but you know, bear with me. I am musically illiterate. Okay.
Maybe.
So I can't even keep a beat. But I know data science, and you know both. So you have view to both of these worlds. What are the parallels? Is there any hope for me?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's hard because a lot of the time when people think about music, they think about performance, right? And that's a very specific type of way of thinking about musical culture. It's a bit Western, it's a bit European in a lot of ways. And there's many other ways to engage in music that isn't the sort of like performer on the stage type tradition. Most of music probably is perception, not necessarily production. So to say, oh, I'm not good at music, like unless you listen to music and it really like sounds like pots and pans clanging and you're kind of this really specific group of people called amusics or amusia, you probably have more musicality than you think. And the lab that I was last part of in the Netherlands, the guy that runs the group there, Henk Jan Honing, has written tons of really good stuff really tries to dispel this narrative that sometimes people get where they were told once that when they were a kid they can't sing or they can't keep a beat or something. And it really stops people from continuing to pursue it because like, well, if I can't be the best at it, why even try? And I think that's a really harmful narrative that music educators have done. But the big difference between music and I think data science is a lot of music does have to happen in real time. Because you're performing. And of course you can record, you can be a producer, or you can do all this other kind of stuff, which opens up really nice avenues for people who feel like they're musical and they want to do musical things, but they really struggle with that real-time performance aspect of it. But like in data science and software engineering, it's not often you're asked to do something in real time with the exception of like live coding interviews. And there's of course lots of understanding about like, are those actually representative of who you are as a data scientist if I can't like code a random forest model from scratch, you know, under pressure when there's like a bunch of money on the line. So like, yeah, you got to be careful about, thinking that being good at one thing necessarily translates to another.
I want to jump into the conversation. I mean, of course, I've been knowing Dave for quite some time, and I've seen him firsthand learning things with the old books, you know, they still existed. I remember this big book he always carried with him while learning skills in R specifically. I think here, like at NIU, we have a broad audience of people from different majors and colleges. And when I go to my classes and I teach data analytics, some of the people in my classes are taking like a data analytics minor more for their resume, right? They always say, okay, but I'm going to be an accountant or I'm going to be a marketing guy, or maybe marketing is not a good idea not to learn that. But anyway, they see as data science or like skills like R as not needed, right? Or like I'm getting them for my resume, but I'm probably not going to use it in real life. And when I think about you and the work that you were doing for your PhD, I'm thinking like, okay, music definitely doesn't need data scientist. I mean, if I have to be like from a close-minded perspective. So what would be, and I don't know how much we have time to share about what you are doing with music or what you are doing with music, but in general, what would be your personal experience with it, and what drones you to kind of like break boundaries? And it doesn't matter what is your major, but there is used in learning those techniques and applying them to find some nuance and answer different questions from what all your colleagues probably were capable of answering, just because you were building those skills to do those data analysis projects.
Yeah, that's really a good question, because a lot of the time students in all disciplines believe, ask the question, why am I learning this? Why do I have to do this? This is not what I'm going to do for my job. Can I just, you know, sort of fast track this? And that's, it's funny you say that, because I can think of so many parallels for the music students that I would teach when I was at Louisiana who would say exact things like that. I think the answer is somewhat the same in the sense that during your time in school, you'll never be like as free to like stretch your mind and learn things as you will once you're done. So unless you're working full time and being a student, which is hard, and people have that, that's like, of course, a double whammy. So you're not going to have that. I'm thinking specifically about students who are full time and that's all that they're doing. And it feels busy, and you are busy, especially if like tons of credit hours. But in terms of your mental capacity to not have to think about that many other things, that goes away as soon as you leave school, which is, I think, one of the reasons a lot of us, I'm sure, on this call stayed in school for a lot longer than maybe we should have in some ways. And we like to learn this stuff, and you realize that, like, as soon as you start to get good at it, you're like, oh, shoot, I don't have much time left to really stretch myself in this capacity and, like, make these connections. And it feels like you have these silos because I'm a marketing major or I'm a music theater major. But when you're a student, you're just, everything is so new and so fresh, and it's so easy to meet other people who are into something completely different than you, that this is really a time to push yourself, because the thing is, you don't know what's going to be helpful later or not. Like, I swore when I was a music student that I would never want a desk job or whatever, because I thought it would be boring. That's because I had no idea how intellectually stimulating like programming can be, in terms of like it being a very similar type of puzzle and feeling to like learning an etude on my trumpet. And that's, of course, was naive of me as a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old. So I think that we have responsibility as educators to just keep our students' brains open to the possibility that they don't know what's they're going to find interesting, because you're still developing, right? When you're a student, and that's a big part of being an undergraduate, is finding out all of these other things that you could be, and trying to convince people not to wall themselves off too early. And I think that happens for everybody, but particularly with undergraduates, because you have such resources in terms of human resources at your disposal that you won't have once you start working for like a little or any kind of company.
Just to add to that, I completely agree with you. I just like find it interesting when they think that it's not needed, but then they get promotion because they innovate whatever the company was doing in the past, thanks to knowing those skills. And I have a few examples in the past. I do have a follow-up question, though, because I think we learned the hard way, right? At our times, there was books. There was Stack Overflow when we were learning coding, and pretty much it. I mean, we can talk to each other and ask professor in statistics, computer science, whatever we were going to, right? But nowadays there is a new tools that potentially can make it much easier. What is your take on this? If you had to go all the way back and learning R again or whatever statistical software, would you rather I do the hard way, the way you did it, that took longer time? Or would you say it would be great to have ChatGPT or something similar to that?
I knew this was coming. He was going to ask this. I knew it.
I know. Yeah. I like the hard way. But...
Yeah, it's hard. We think about this. I thought about this a lot at the last couple of universities that I was working at when I was doing postdocs, and I would talk to students about this too, and also get into sort of arguments about what you're necessarily doing. The first thing is sort of on my last answer, talking about like you're really shooting yourself in the foot if you close yourself off too early. Like part of the and of course, this maybe just also parallels from my music background, is that you have to go through the pain of learning something in the difficult way, because there's no shortcuts to being good at a musical instrument. Like there's a small group of people that maybe just pick it up and they're kind of like naturals or whatever, but like the rest of us mortals have to put in the time. We always used to joke in music conservatory that like talent runs out at age 18 and then you have to start like working for it. And I feel
Yeah, that's really helpful. Yeah, sorry.
So that was something that we all often said to each other. And I think it's the same thing with other things that you want to get good at. So not only, because it's like a lot of things, people think, oh, I'm learning the content. Like, I have to learn how to program in R because R is going to be this path to doing something. But like if you're an undergraduate and you're learning R and you're an information systems student or whatever, you're learning R. But if this is like the first truly hard thing that you've had to learn, you're also learning how to teach yourself how to do something very difficult.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
So you don't want to necessarily, you know, shortchange your ability to learn and become necessarily like, you know, completely dependent on some external technology to do your thinking for you. And you need to, I think, you know, you have to get so far with something that you're really passionate about and you really do know a lot about so that when you do, you know, type something into something like ChatGPT and say, oh, tell me a little bit about like, you know, historical practice of the cornetto in the 14th century, something that I maybe know probably more about than other people on the street. And then I see like what it sort of splurts out. And I'm like, well, it's pretty vague. And like, that's really missing sort of like the key things that like I would talk about if I was, you know, doing a lecture on cornetto performance. And then you realize how sort of seductive, really nicely typed language can be to make you trick yourself into thinking that you do understand something. Whereas in reality, I think what's happening is it's very easy to process. And then if you do that for things that you are learning that you don't really know that you know, you'll be sort of, again, seductively deceived to believe that you understand this when in reality, you're just, you know, you're just like drinking something down that's going down really nice. But it's not necessarily, attached or has any sort of like long stay to it.
I agree 100%. I think when you mentioned learning the hard way, people who learn the hard way become actually better users of AI. They, you're mentioning the, I'm sorry if I say it wrong, cornetto performance?
Cornetto, it's like
cornetto.
Sorry, I should have picked something that is obscure.
Russ, don't cut that out. I want to be embarrassed.
So that's easy. I mean, whenever you want to be embarrassed, we can keep that in publicly, okay?
So that performance, if you ask AI that question, you probably understand, you fully understand the answer. And if there is something over there that you didn't know, that enhances what you already knew. But someone who has no idea and relies on that is going to be stuck with that vague knowledge that the AI is presenting. And similar to coding, if you learn how to code from scratch, which is learning the hard way, and you ask AI to write a code for you, and it's probably like using some, like it's learned online, and people online don't code perfectly. So you, if there are issues with that, or not even if there are issues with that, you understand why a line of code exists there. That AI coding is more useful to you than someone who doesn't know those intricacies. That's why I also agree that we have to teach them the hard way, at least in the beginning, and we shouldn't let them, open themselves, let go too early. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I completely know that. And I think a big part of it also is having to somehow undo with students the fact that, like, school is not, like, this is a very personal beef of mine, but school is not job training. Like, you people are told this narrative that you go to college so you can get a job. And that was true, definitely, I don't know, 20 years ago or something like that, where it really distinguished you in a lot of ways. But even before that, like getting a college degree and the whole idea of the liberal arts education, if you go back, you know, hundreds of years to think about what's, you know, liberal arts education, what was the quadrivium, why are people just learning stuff for the sake of learning it? Like this is, again, especially for something, I don't know, like computer science, like computer science is different than what you end up doing in terms of programming for the man when you end up getting your first job. And if you look at like, I don't know, like those initial textbooks that like talked about learning computer science, like that structure and interpretation of computer languages, that text that used to have for the MIT introductory computer science class, it's like all written in Lisp or something. Like it just half of the text is them talking about how interesting these problems are and how it's like something that you want to do because it's like a challenging problem. And there's these, it's like intellectually fulfilling in its own right. And of course, those types of skills can also give you a career or make you money or whatever. But like, it's easier to do that if you have a total command of the sort of things that are abstracted, as opposed to like, oh, I really need to learn, you know, DuckDB, or I really need to learn Rust now, or I really need to learn this, because you just get too caught up in the in something that doesn't necessarily transfer as well as an abstracted idea. And like, university is all about learning these more abstracted ideas so you can become a stronger thinker and learner, not just be good at another. Yeah.
And plus, it's based on learning, right? You've been saying the word learning a lot, and that's a big beef I have when like students only focus on the grade side of things and not what, you know, the learning of the skills that you can then apply and, you know, enhance later on in your career.
Yeah, it's hard because from their perspective, I get it, because like, you know, grades are that gateway that they have to for everything they need to do, especially when everything feels so impossible and whatever. I get why people get hung up on it, but yeah, it is. I mean, if it was up to me, we would just have pass fail and everything, and it would be
content. Thank you. I need you.
That's just my team. People have
to. But also, like, to be honest with you, and I know, like, we'll probably get to talk more about what you're doing now and other stuff. But like, honestly, all the conversation I had with people, practitioners, like, and I asked them, what are you looking for in candidates? That none of them ever answered to me GPA. I see their points, like, on, you know, for scholarship and specific things, that is still a requirement. And I think it's our fault as university to kind of put it that way. Also, because you have you're raising the opportunity on unethical things, you know, because if you have to get a specific grade to get to what you need to get, maybe you find a shortcut sometimes when you didn't have the time to really prepare for it. So I think we need to do our own reflections of this. But anyway, but practitioners, show me what you can do. And I think this is a perfect transition for the next thing I want to talk about. And the fact that I think to get a freelancer in this world, you really need to showcase all that you can do. So how do you approach that? What type of suggestion do you have for somebody that not trying to find competitors for you, but somebody that is considering like becoming a freelancer, solopreneur, whatever you want to call it?
I think the thing with that is that you kind of have to forget all of your data stuff, is what I'm sort of learning in doing a lot of this. And I basically put on your business hat, and you have to, when I'm in this space, I try to imagine myself as like an okay business guy who like happens to be very good at statistics and programming and all this other kind of stuff. Because if you can communicate to people that you can solve their problems and you can make their day-to-day life easier in a way that the value that you're going to add to their business is greater than that of what they are going to pay you to do it, then you're good. Of course, right now, economy, not that great. I've had several recently, you know, drop out of things because, you know, they're an e-commerce company and they're worried about this financial instability of like the tariffs and all that kind of stuff. So this isn't like a golden bullet that's like, oh, once you master this, then everything's going to go fly forward. But I will say, when things do go well, that's what the clear narrative is that the value I will deliver is greater than the value, monetary value, that you're going to pay me to necessarily do this. And with freelancers, you know, sometimes it's something specific, right? They're getting a deal because they don't have to pay you healthcare or, you know, employment or all these other types of things, right? So they're like, okay, we have this one specific thing. I'd love if someone just took this thorn out of my side. And, you know, sometimes you're the guy to do it, and sometimes they actually have to hire a full team to do that.
So Dave, when you're looking at that one, and again, if we get too close into this one, let us know, but how do you know when it's too much or it's beyond your skill set? And again, this is, I want this is very broad, because I think there's a lot of conversation about being self-aware and being present and knowing who you are. But then we also have students and ourselves that were like, well, go for that opportunity, you know, of course, apply for things you're not qualified for, ask for the raise, like, which all of that stuff is valid. Like, you should be doing those things. But when do you, whether it's a specific gig, a specific contract, an opportunity, and Or what's your process to determine, okay, this, I am not going to be able to handle this, or this is not my right skill set? Or, and how did you develop that as a person too?
Yeah. I think a big part of it is having frank conversations as soon as possible about things. And you have to establish trust quickly with someone so they know that you can be honest and they can be honest about stuff, because everybody kind of wants to hedge, right? Everybody wants to come off as smarter than they are, or that the data is better in a better place than it necessarily is. And taking it in steps, I think, is the next thing, and saying, okay, this is what this is, and being realistic about what necessarily it's going to take for them to get what they want. And that's also another thing too. Do they actually know what they want?
Ooh, good point.
Them in figuring out what that is, or like how that business objective translates into something else. And then the other, I think, good bit of advice on that, someone suggested a few weeks ago that I read that Fundamentals of Data Engineering book by Joe Reese, I think is his name. I might be forgetting the author. He talks a lot about the idea that, you know, you want to get, I think, like quick wins fast. And you want to think of a lot of choices as like, he talks about, I think this was like an Amazon anecdote from the book, where it's like, you have these two way doors where you say, okay, we can do this, and we're going to go do it this way for now, because that's what makes sense. But no, you can change that, right? And if you make a decision that helps out the business and they end up growing, and then the solution that you suggested for them actually grew their business, but it's no longer appropriate, well, technically you just got to walk back out that door, and you have more resources now to then go do something else. So I think getting too caught up on that and saying, well, I got to pick the perfect technology, or I got to do something else, really gets caught up more interested in as data scientists, which is like, oh, I like these tech stacks, or I want to learn this thing, or whatever. But at the end of the day, if you're a business owner, like, it's not that you don't care about it. Of course you care about it if you're like, you know, a Silicon Valley startup, you know, but if you're just helping out a business that wants to, you know, increase their bottom line, they're trusting you to kind of do something that's going to make sense given the information you have at the time.
That's really useful information. I'm sorry, Biagio. I really appreciate that, Dave. Biagio, go ahead.
No, yeah, I have kind of like I don't know if it's a broad question, but it's just like, you know, your path to where you are right now, it's super interesting. And the fact that you navigated different worlds, right? So the academia, and then industry, and then now you starting as an entrepreneur path, right? What do you think are the commonalities between them, and what do you think are the stuff that you are completely reinventing yourself to be more on this new path that you are right now?
Yeah, I thought about this a lot when I was jumping ship on the academia thing. And I thought like, oh, what I'm good at is learning, or what I'm good at is this kind of stuff. But then I saw there's sort of these skill gaps in my own resume, or like tools that I like to work with, to turn things around quickly. And I thought, like, well, not everybody does this. Like, I'm more of an R guy because I come from academia and I like these really fancy statistical models and I like making graphs.
Me too.
And I'm less guy. Yeah, I can do some Python. Like, I will use ChatGPT for stuff like that to help me along. Sometimes I just think through things in R a lot of the time.
You got to learn it the hard way, you know?
Exactly. because it's more familiar to me. So it's like, there's the... ease and familiarity conflation is also another thing. But what I did realize is that when you're doing something like this, it's much better, I think, to lead with your strengths. So pick things that you're good at and try to forge, basically go forward on that without necessarily backing up and then restarting out like something completely different. So if you know you're good at something, lean into that space. And that's why I've been quite interested recently in like moving into the sort of performing arts data world, which is sort of this next project undertaking. But it came from this idea of like, okay, what am I actually good at? What can I necessarily move forward, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to apply for jobs being like, you know, a data engineer that mostly uses like a bunch of Python and a ton of like whatever stack the company has to do something that I'm not necessarily that good at. And I really like this idea of, like, you know, do the things and try to get to do the jobs, especially if you're a bit more senior, that only you could do. But I don't know if that's not really good advice for junior people, because they haven't been around as long. So they kind of...
You never know.
Well, you never know. And everybody has interesting things about them, yeah, as individuals, and subject matter expertise that they can lean into that other people can't. So of course there's, yeah, going to be that. So maybe just yeah, not so much.
Play your strength, and if you have any type of know-how that brings you, like, gives you advantage over other people that, you know, they're probably good at building those models, but they're good at building those models in other industries. Sometimes it's not the same models that you need to use for a different industry, and plus the know-how is not there. So you definitely have an advantage. I don't know. Do you know Jan Holtz?
He's
a freelancer in French, and this guy is pretty much does data visualization only. Mm-hmm. That's his strength. And I think that's the way he's making a good path right now, is by just playing what he's good at and not trying to go outside his personal, you know, what he's capable of doing.
I was wondering if you were pursuing clients with performing arts background, and how the intersection was. And, you know, when I think about companies that need data consultancy and things like that, is like, oh, logistics, sales, and things like that. Yeah, but yeah, that makes sense that there is probably a huge amount of data over there in performing arts industry, because everything is digitized and you can save data and analyze it in very interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't my original intention to necessarily go into this next thing that's a bit more, a bit of a risk, I mean, in some ways for me, of this next thing that I'm going to do. So I was doing this work back in the end of last year with a client, and it was keeping me busy for about 2 or 3 months. And I had some time in between that and what I thought was going to be my next project before it fell through, to sort of like learn some new stuff. So I figured, okay, I'm going to learn something that I've been meaning to get better at for a long time. So I've never really been good at making interactive dashboards. I can make dashboards just fine. So I said, okay, I'll start on a project where I can sort of pick something I know where I want to lean more into. So I have this background in the arts and the performing arts. And I'd been reading a lot of stuff about kind of like this, basically what people are doing with ticketing revenue in the performing arts. And I think people are really realizing that, like, getting people to stay, and like anything that mirrors the SaaS subscription model of like recurring clientele, is much better from a sort of organizational management / financial planning point than trying to always get new people in the concert hall. So that was really interesting me from a sort of high level at the time. So I thought, like, okay, maybe I should kind of like get into this world. So I started playing around with some Shiny tools. So I started playing around actually with the Posit Shiny LLM to help me sketch out a couple of different sort of interfaces for something that I thought would be helpful. And I showed it to a few people and they thought it was quite interesting. And they're like, oh yeah, you should keep going with this. And then the more I built with it, with the sort of goal being, oh, I just want to get good at Shiny. And the more I showed it to people, said, oh, what would you change? What would you add? Is this interesting to you? Is this valuable to you? The more signal that I got to sort of keep going, and maybe it could actually solve a real problem for real people out in the world. So I ended up actually going much further with this project than I would for like a portfolio thing. And I'm actually planning on, I think, launching it next week, where it's basically going to be, you know, essentially built the tool that I wish existed if I had to do the types of analyses that people say that they want done. And that feels like quite straightforward of like something to build. It's very hyper niche in the sense that, you know, not a lot of people are going to try to basically pigeonhole themselves as like data experts in the performing arts. There are, of course, analytics companies that do this type of thing. So of course there are people that do it, but yeah, it's something that I think could provide.
That's very interesting. It is ticketing, and they could apply to anything that has tickets, not just concerts. You could do sports, probably. And
yeah, exactly. Well, you have to think about what's the model, though. So, like with of the performance. So, if you have like something like a symphony performance or a run of a theater show, you might have 15 productions of like Midsummer Night's Dream or something. Whereas, like the Super Bowl only happens once per year.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our ticketed thing. So that I was very interested in like this problem of like and the same people go to those events quite regularly, whereas like different people are going to go to the Super Bowl. So lots of interesting statistical problems as well, which also drew me to it of like, how do you model this? And yeah, so I was like, yeah, what are the things that you want to measure? Yeah, and it just became quite an interesting thing to get into, because I was also reading a lot of Rob Walling's stuff a few months ago. So he has these two books, one called Start Small, Stay Small, another one called like the SaaS Playbook. And really the argument he's making is like, if you want to, make some money in software and you have the, basic software chops and some business understanding of a niche, like if you can build a tool that helps just a small amount of people and they pay for it regularly, get enough of them, you basically have a full-time job right there. And that really appealed to me, because I'm very much like a lifestyle career type person when it comes to like, why did I learn these skills? What do I want to do with my time on earth? And it's not necessarily become senior vice president of a Fortune 500 company.
I am completely blown away by this whole conversation, Dave. And we're going to wrap up here, but I want to finish this whole conversation with probably one of the easiest, but also difficult and probably not answerable questions. So before, do you have a favorite musician that would go back to and listen to? I'm going every time. I love these ones.
I have another question after that. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. All right. So even if you need time to think on it, then Dave, like we can pivot. But if you got an answer.
It's just so hard. Yeah, I mean, I have favorite like groups that I like listening to, and definitely favorite artists. But I also am quite active still in looking for new music. So there's always a recency thing there. I mean, my favorite band is the Dirty Projectors, but that's, I think, just because there's a lot of very specific memories I have from listening to that music at a specific time in my life. And I just love the way I could go about that on about that for a while.
Amazing. But. Yeah. We'll have another episode for that. Just that. Okay.
And also, I mean, there's lots of jazz guys I love listening to as well. And it's a deeply unfair question, but
perfect.
I would say, that's always my East trade, my go-to answer of like, if
but I, what is your current one, current favorite music you listen to right now?
Oh, at the easier. Moment, I'm listening to a lot of Chet Baker at the moment. So,
ooh,
so
okay.
1950s, late 1950s, Chet Baker. In my free time, I've been getting the trumpet back out, actually, because I have a lot more free time at the moment than when I was in academia. And I've been trying to transcribe some of his solos. On those albums, he's not playing as insanely as he would on other ones. So that's it at the moment.
Awesome. And then Biagio.
Thank you very much.
No, I have a more broad question, like for our audience, any tips or anything you want to share about what are you trying to do in the short term, something like that. But then I guess I have to ask the question about what is your favorite music when you code. I guess I need to ask that. Which one helps you coding and be more productive? Go back to the music.
Yeah, when I'm coding, I've been listening to a lot of Mitch Murder recently. So he's like this modern guy that makes this kind of like 80s nostalgia music. And it's very, but it's much more high quality. And I listen to a lot of those sort of weird YouTube endless mixtapes of like original video game soundtracks and all this other just stuff that it's like familiar enough, but not distracting enough. But that's been my coding go-to recently. Anything else is too distracting. And what was your other question?
No, I mean, if you want to share like any advice, or you want to share any of your future plan that you have, anything that you think it can be useful for our audience,
for our students.
I guess that I'll share one of my thoughts that I've been sharing with some other data people I've been taking calls with recently. And I think right now we're in this moment with data where it is a completely saturated market, like the economy is not in a good place at the moment. And everybody, we have benefited now from this sort of like wonderful democratization of data science education. So there's tons of great stuff on the internet to teach yourself how to do so many different things that just did not exist when Biagio and I were in grad school. I think like the best thing at the time was downloading the PDF of the introduction to statistics R and just like trying to read that.
Y'all were real cool at LSU, huh?
Yeah.
I paid for that book. No, I didn't.
Yeah. But I think because of that, anyone can really claim to be a data scientist too, right? Where it's like, oh, I'm going to get ChatGPT to generate a bunch of code and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. You know, I think in some ways it's good. In some ways it's bad for reasons we've discussed. But I think the future or the interesting future is actually going to be data scientists who just sort of try to forget about the fact that they're data scientists and think about real problems that can be solved with the skills that they do have, even if it's not necessarily that great. Because if you're a good data scientist, you're working for a company, you're providing more value to them than they're paying you. You know, there's also nothing I don't know what the best way to say it is, but like why not just do your own thing? Right? Why not just pick something smaller? Of course, there's a lot of reasons, like the stability of it, all that kind of stuff. But if you have a regular job and you know, don't do some random ass side project to kind of like keep up your chops and learn some weird technology, just try to start the smallest business you possibly can and get some people to pay you for it. Like that is in it itself is psychologically worth so much more than saying, oh, I learned a bunch of like LangChain stuff, or I learned the weird technology, or now I'm, you know, AWS certified in this thing. Like if that's what you want to do, fine. But if you really want to go down a rabbit hole that has the opportunity to be psychologically rewarding in a way that I think doing certifications isn't, it's just literally try to start your own little business, and you'll also learn so much about why you're actually doing what you're doing on the job, because you'll be forced to re-see your work through a non-data science lens, and that is in itself just immeasurably valuable. So that's what I've been really interested in recently. How do we sort of give ourselves the worst MBA education in the world and then go out there and try to build a product? But that's where I see the future being is like, yeah, you get all these people who are good at data science, they have some business knowledge, and then they just take on a niche of their own as opposed to try to, you know, become the next another data scientist at Google.
And I think one other thing that you are not saying, but I've seen in you lately is how much you are investing in networking with the right people, right? And even you know, showcasing what you can do. So I've seen some very impressive project that you are putting out there, and I've seen that how much that side of things sometimes for people that are good at coding is not natural, right? The networking part, the social part, but then in real life is what sets you apart to probably, you know, get where you want to get.
Yeah, so true. I maybe credit a lot of my music background for the being able to do the hang and hang out with people and get to know them. But yeah, if there's advice for younger people, it's start to, like, I know it sounds so cliche, but your net work is your net worth, and you just have no idea who's going to be helpful for you sooner rather than later. You would much rather help someone out who you know than you don't. And I know that's like obvious, but if you could just invest in meeting lots of people and being a nice person, and then also being able to demonstrate in some sort of clear empirical way that you can do what you can say you do by having like a GitHub portfolio like that. I mean, you're ahead of 90% of people in that way. I think that's what I know, but harder now. It's not a good time to, if you listen to this podcast in 2025. Not as easy as it used to be. I used to get headhunted all the time, and I don't anymore.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for your time, your advice, your perspective. This is really valuable. And I'm incredibly grateful. So we wish you the best and have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a nice time.
And thank you for listening to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by Northern Illinois University, where your future is our focus. And please, remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.